You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 23rd, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everybody. And on this date in 1995, comet Hale-Bopp was discovered.
Hale-Bopp.
For the first time.
Good old Hale-Bopp. Yeah. I think the mothership was
behind
that, right?
You know,
right?
It became visible to the naked eye about a year later. And shortly after that, in 1997, some folks over at the Heaven's Gate cult decided to take the eternal ride on the tail of the comet as it passed by, and they are no longer gracing us with their presence. So
that was very sad.
Very sad. Shows the power that a charismatic cult leader can have. It's amazing.
Absolutely.
But the comet was cool.
It was very cool.
The comet was cool.
Yeah. That was. It was up there for a long time. It's very nice.
Yeah.
Like a little snowball hanging in the sky.
We have another bit of astronomical news this week. Shortly after coming up with the new category Plutoid, which are dwarf planets like Pluto that cross the orbit of Neptune and are in the Kuiper Belt, the third Plutoid has been officially named. So we have Pluto, the archetype of the Plutoid. We have Eris, E-R-E-S. And now we have Maki Maki.
That's right.
Maki Maki.
Maki Maki.
I love that.
That's my favorite name of all of them.
With a little Cajun spice or something, yeah.
It just doesn't seem right to me. I don't know. It just doesn't sound like a Plutoid to me.
Doesn't sound like a Plutoid? Well, they did get away from the Greek mythology, and this one is Easter Island mythology, the creator god, I guess, of the Eastern Island mythos. Mm. So they did break from the classic Greek.
They did.
I think that's all right.
But they are still embracing mythology with the naming of these bodies that they continually find. I guess more for tradition, I guess, than any other reason.
Yeah, that's cool. I think it's a good system to use for naming heavenly bodies.
Sure.
So now we have the solar system is getting very complicated. We have eight planets, and we now have four dwarf planets, Ceres, which is in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, and three Plutoids, as I said. Pluto, which has one moon, Charon. Eris, which has a moon, Dysnomia. And now Maki Maki, which doesn't have a moon as far as
as far as we know. But, you know, and there's going to be more coming down the body.
Oh, yeah.
There's going to be a lot
more. Right. Another 41 discovered objects in the solar system might belong in the category of dwarf planet. And they're also saying that estimates are that the actual number of dwarf planets might increase to 200 once the entire Kuiper Belt is fully studied and explored. It'll take a long time.
We're going to have to come up with some new mnemonic devices.
I have to start naming them after skeptics. That's my recommendation.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
And scientists. You know, scientists and skeptics.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Oh, that'll work. Well, better than Disney characters, you know.
Yeah, like Pluto.
Although that was a very good marketing. I have to say Pluto remains the most popular planet with children.
Now, you know how people are kind of upset that recently, you know, Pluto was demoted into the category of dwarf planet. But at the same time, you know, there's going to come a time in which dwarf planets, obviously, are going to outnumber the main planets. So Pluto will be in a majority. We will be in a minority.
It's not about the number, though, is it? I mean,
it's about size.
Size matters. Sorry, Pluto. Get over it.
There's a trans-Neptunian object, a TNO, that they've called Orcus. Mm-hmm. Of all things, and
but that's a designation. That's not an official name yet.
No, that is a name. No, it's a.
But it's not big enough to be a dwarf planet.
It's a Plutino, is what they're calling it.
Oh,
a Plutino.
You made that up.
But the name Orcus is a demonic name, if I recall. Is it not?
You know, we just had our skeptic drink contest, and now I kind of wish that we had made a Plutini.
Shaken, not stirred.
Maybe for the next round.
But Evan, you know, Pluto is the lord of the underworld, so they do sort of stick with the underworld theme out there in the Kuiper Belt.
Sure, I understand that.
A Plutini would have the tiniest little olive floating in it. Sorry, go on.
and lots of ice. Dirty ice. You get up
a
dirty
ice. Yeah, a lot of dirty ice. Yes. A dirty martini. I like this.
The next news item has to do with the misadventures of alternative medicine. This comes from the UK. A woman by the name of Dawn Page, age 52, you know, wanted to lose a little weight. So she sought out a nutritional therapist and life coach, a woman by the name of Barbara Nash, who was trained at the College of Natural Nutrition. which should have been her first warning sign. Uh-huh. For those of us in the know, for skeptics, the word natural these days is just shorthand for quackery. If you hear any peals of thunder in the background, that's because we're having a bit of a lightning storm. Hopefully the podcast won't abruptly end.
Hopefully we won't abruptly end, right? Surrounded by electronic equipment in the middle of an electrical storm.
Although I do think the lightning in the background is really cool, so I hope you can hear that. But anyway, so Barbara Nash put this woman, Dawn Page, on the Amazing Hydration Diet. Now, this diet included forced drinking pints of water, starting with four pints of extra water a day, and drastically reducing her salt intake. This is a prescription that a first-year medical student will recognize as a prescription for disaster.
They prescribe those now, huh?
She started to get lightheaded and was vomiting, wasn't feeling very well. So Barbara Nash does what most alternative practitioners do. They interpret anything that happens after they prescribe their intervention as evidence that it's working. Whatever it is.
That's the key part where it all goes wrong. It's like, you know, we could put up with the very first crappy treatment if only the person getting the treatment said, you know what, this isn't working, I'm not feeling well, let me get a second opinion. The people who do that live or don't get brain damaged.
Right. Yeah. For practitioners, the basic clinical, you know, practice, if the patient's getting worse, you got to reassess them. You don't just assume it means that your treatment's working.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Was this person the first guinea pig to go on this diet?
No.
No, no, on this diet, no, no, no.
No, because this is like standard detox where it's just assumed that more water is always going to be better. You're flushing your system out. Before this has ever had a name, it's been around.
Yeah.
I mean, I know plenty of people who do things like that, but granted, not to the extent of this. And if they start feeling bad, then I kind of trust them a little more to actually stop and go to a doctor.
Yeah, I think that's probably, you know, where this case went different than most other cases. I think most other people, once they're vomiting and feeling like crap, might not proceed with the treatment. But she went back to the nutritional therapist, and Nash told her to increase her fluid intake to 6 liters a day and reduce her salt even more.
Wow.
And that caused her to have a seizure.
I couldn't even read the whole article in one go. It was skeeving me out so much.
Yeah. So, again, you know, this is the kind of thing that, you know, basic kind of physiology, sort of first-year medical student stuff, you'd realize this is just incompetent. This is what you would do if you're trying to kill somebody. You drive down the sodium to dangerous levels. You know, our bodies actually need sodium and all the electrolytes, actually chloride, whatever, to be within a fairly narrow range in order for the physiology on the cellular level to work out okay, for your brain and your heart and those kind of important organs to work really well. So when the sodium gets too low, one of the things that can happen is you can become delirious, first of all. You also can have a seizure, and that's exactly what happened to her. She apparently had some permanent brain damage as a consequence of her very low sodium and her seizure. It's not clear from the documents that I have, from the news reporting, exactly how that happened, what the mechanism was, but it's certainly plausible. So then she, of course, sued, or her husband sued, the nutritionist, and the news that's being reported now is that they just won an award of £800,000, which I understand is real money.
I really wish that in addition to that, that they could, that the nutritionist could face some kind of criminal charge for this, because it seems like negligence or endangerment or some fancy term for you
like
effed
stupidity.
Up and hurt someone. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be careful prosecuting malpractice as criminal. I mean, you need something more than just malpractice. Like, it has to be depraved indifference or reckless endangerment or something more, which this may rise to that level. I'm not disagreeing with that, but you do have to think that, just legalistic terms, you know, what is it beyond just the incompetence that you'd be prosecuting criminally. But this is a symptom of a broken system, right? This is not – and the BBC report on this did a very good job of not just reporting this case but putting it in the context of this is a broken system of regulation in the country. So she got a degree from the College of Natural Nutrition. She was allowed to practice. You know, this is the kind of thing that has a general acceptance in the culture now, and it victimizes people like Dawn Page because it seems like this is it seems superficially perfectly legitimate. I mean, healthcare shouldn't be a let the buyer beware kind of market.
Steve,
you know what I mean?
How much is the national healthcare system contribute to something like this? Because, you know, we don't have that here in the United States, but other countries do.
Yeah, well, they think that the government contributes to it in different ways within their system based upon ineffective regulation. So in the UK, it's the National Health Service and what they cover, what they recognize. In this country, it's what insurance companies will pay for. It's, you know, the National Center for Complementary Alternative Medicine, you know, what the government will spend research dollars on. In whatever the system is, you know, the regulators do have a lot of power over what gets recognized as legitimate. So it's not just the scientists, it's not just the physicians or the scientific practitioners who are deciding what's legitimate, what is the standard of care. In many ways, it's also what regulators allow. And that's what you're talking about here. So I looked at a little bit at this College of Natural Nutrition, and, you know, it's just really, I mean, you could be reading a psychic's website. I mean, it's, you read it, and it's the standard kind of new agey, natural philosophy stuff, really, really squishy. They say that their philosophy is they want to empower their patients. Yeah, that's pretty standard alternative medicine jargon now. We're going to empower their patients with the knowledge of how their current health picture has arisen over their lifetime and previous generations. So they want to show them how to, you know, support their own healing with nutrition and so-called naturopathic techniques. It's all very evidence and logic and science free. It's just all the feel-good new agey stuff. And it's unfortunate that they get to attach the label nutritionist to this kind of stuff, because nutrition is a legitimate medical science, biological science. But now it's just completely overwhelmed by this kind of alternative nonsense. And this is the result. And this is not an isolated case. I've actually, you know, I don't see a lot of this kind of stuff. I've personally seen two cases of this. Neither patient suffered permanent damage because they got admitted to the hospital and we knew how to treat them. But I've seen patients with seizures and acute delirious states because of wacky nutritional advice they got from either the guy at the health food store or some nutritionist following this kind of philosophical stuff.
This is going to get a lot worse before it gets any better. I mean, how far can this go?
It's all the way, Bob.
It's really, it really can. What's it going to be like in 5 or 10 years? I think we're just going to be...
We're on our way to finding out.
Surrounded by this crap. It's going to be bad.
They also often have the media on their side. I mean, Steve, like you pointed out, not in this particular case of this article, so it would seem. But more often than not, media is on the side of alternative medicine.
Well, it's the dog bites man. You know, alternative medicine for a long time was the dog bites man story. Oh, this, you know, fringe, you know, treatment is now being accepted or may seem to work or whatever. But now I do think this is one of the turning points is that, well, maybe they're charlatans after all is becoming kind of the dog bites man story. So the BBC actually did a good job, you know, of reporting on this. So I think I'm seeing more of that now, that some reporters are getting a bit more savvy. It's still probably in the vast minority, but at least occasionally you'll encounter a savvy reporter who kind of sees that it's okay now to say that this is all bunk.
Every candle in the dark helps.
Yep.
Especially when you have like a sexy actress or something who is advocating for the side of good for a change.
That's right, and this takes us to our next news item. That was a
nice
very nice segue.
You know, I had a dog name segue.
The next news item has to do with Amanda Peet, who is an actress,
yay,
primarily a television actress. I think she's done some movies too.
Yay, actress.
Yay, Amanda Peet.
So she put out a video and did an interview where she said that, you know, when it came time to make the decision whether or not to vaccinate her children, that she did the research, and her brother-in-law is a pediatrician, so that really helped. And she's found that, you know, vaccines are safe, that they protect against disease, infectious diseases, and that all the hysteria about a possible connection to autism is not based upon evidence. So she decided not only to vaccinate her kids, but to come out and say, this is the right thing to do, this is what I advocate, you know, that you shouldn't be afraid to vaccinate your kids. And she also said that parents who don't vaccinate their children are relying upon those other parents who do, like parasites. She used the word parasites. She got a lot of flack for that.
She apologized.
She did apologize, which, you know.
Should she have?
I don't know. I think so. She apologized by saying that term was divisive, and yeah, you know, it's pretty inflammatory. But then she backed up why she said it. She's absolutely right.
Yeah, that's the way to do it.
Yeah, which is fine. At least she didn't back down from the point, which is when you get to over 90-95% of a population vaccinated, you get what's called herd immunity, which means that a virus or an infection can't really spread from person to person because they're too few and far between. That's herd immunity. If you're one of the unvaccinated, you're relying upon herd immunity, which exists because all the other people are vaccinating. And that is kind of a parasitic thing to do. But here's the thing, that there are some people who cannot be vaccinated, some children, for example, who cannot be vaccinated because they have some underlying illness. And they can't tolerate the vaccines, or they won't respond to the vaccines. So they are dependent upon herd immunity. Mm-hmm. But if enough people voluntarily forego vaccines to the point where it drops below the level where you need herd immunity, then you start to get outbreaks. Then the virus can't spread. And this has been happening. We've been having measles outbreaks in this country. The UK has it far worse than we do because they don't have as high vaccination rates as we do. And this is a direct result of the fear-mongering from the anti-vaccination crowds. The other thing that some of the anti-vaccinationists say, trying to be logical, I love it when they try to be logical, it's so cute. They say, what if vaccines work, then you're vaccinated, then it doesn't matter if other people are vaccinated. In other words, herd immunity doesn't matter if you are vaccinated. And if it doesn't work, then nobody needs to get vaccinated. So then there's no argument. But they miss a couple of points. One is that, as I said, there's a vulnerable population who can't be vaccinated. But two, you know, no one said that vaccines are 100% effective. You know, so if vaccines are, you know, 95% effective, that's still really, really good. And that's enough to get to herd immunity so that there's not going to be outbreaks. But if you don't have herd immunity, the 5% or so of people who didn't mount a sufficient immune reaction to the vaccine and don't have immunity from the vaccine are going to be vulnerable to getting infection. So, and those are innocent bystanders. They did everything they were supposed to do. They're just unlucky and not reacting well to the vaccine. And now they're getting sick because somebody else, you know, decided not to to vaccinate their kids. So that argument doesn't hold any water at all. And, you know, there's also diseases like polio where we're actually have eradicated it from countries. We're on the verge of eradicating it from the world. And the only thing that's really keeping us from doing that is fears over vaccines, false fears about conspiracies and vaccines. So that's another point. You know, some of these infectious diseases we might actually, like smallpox, we might actually be able to get rid of completely. But not if people are spreading irrational and not evidence-based fears about vaccines.
So, Steve, a question about that. So, you know, when, in the case of thimerosal, which, if correct me if I'm wrong, is a preservative, is meant to preserve,
That's correct.
But they since have removed the thimerosal at least from the MMR.
Thimerosal was never in the MMR vaccine.
Right.
Thimerosal was in some of the vaccines that were part of the childhood vaccination schedule, but not the MMR.
Is it gone from all vaccinations now?
It's gone from all vaccines that are part of the routine childhood vaccination schedule as of 2002 in this country. It's only in some flu vaccines that children may get, but even then there are thimerosal-free flu vaccines available. The other bit is that thimerosal is only necessary in the multi-shot vaccines because they need a longer shelf life. The single-shot vials don't require it. So we've basically just shifted over to the single-shot vials, which are fine, but they're more expensive, which isn't a big deal in this country. But in, you know, poverty-stricken nations, it's a huge deal. I mean, it's the difference between being able to afford vaccination and not being able to afford it.
So you're saying there's no other preservative in the vaccinations, that nothing else has been invented or come up with. It's preservative free.
Essentially, I mean, there are, if without thimerosal, they do not make multi-dose vaccines. There are manufacturing processes that they use to sterilize and to minimize any fungal or bacterial growth in the vaccines. So there are trace amounts of things that are remain in there, but they're not really ingredients in the vaccines. They're just trace amounts that are left behind from the manufacturing process,
gotcha,
which has to be sterile.
See, I've never understood that, Steve, so thank you for clarifying that.
And then they say, like, oh, there's still thimerosal in the vaccine because there's these really absolutely trace amounts left over from the manufacturing process, but not as an ingredient in the vaccine. Mm-hmm. So that's just another more deception that the anti-vaccinationists engage in. So I wrote about the Amanda Peet thing because I thought it was interesting that she did this. It's, you know, I gave her props for doing that, although I made the point that, you know, I appreciate celebrities who use their fame to support a cause, but I think that it's important for celebrities not to interject their own scientific beliefs or judgment into the scientific community. Let the scientists make, you know, decide what is good science, you know? And I used Michael J. Fox, I think, as the model for what celebrities should do. He's a very effective spokesperson for Parkinson's disease awareness and research, but he's not telling scientists what to research. You know what I mean? He's not saying, this is my own theory of what causes Parkinson's disease. Nobody cares about that. He's a movie star. He's not a television.
Right. The whole point is just to shine a spotlight on, yeah, here's what researchers are doing. Yeah. Go support them. And I think that, yeah, for the most part, I think most celebrities who are not supporting bunk do a really good job of that.
Yeah. And I think the only reason why Amanda Peet came out for a specific, you know, conclusion, vaccine safety, is because of Jenny McCarthy and her ilk. Are, you know, Jenny McCarthy is the former Playboy playmate and MTV star who has become the spokesperson for the anti-vaccinationist movement, the Green R Vaccines campaign, all that crap with her boyfriend Jim Carrey. Now they got Hugh Hefner in the act, and now they're getting Britney Spears in the act.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, wow. But no, I don't think that that's why Amanda Peet got involved, because, as you mentioned, her brother-in-law, mm-hmm, I think, is involved with an organization, and according to her, they came to her and specifically asked if she would be a spokesperson for them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, I agree, but I think that that's happening in reaction to the celebrities on the other side. That's just my opinion, you know.
Yeah. I'm sure it's all tied in.
So this led to a real blog war between myself and David Kirby,
yeah,
and Dr. John Poling, who's the neurologist father of Hannah Poling, who is the girl who has some neurodegenerative disease that has autism features. Her father insists it is autism. I'm not convinced. I think, you know, it just has features of autism. And she has a mitochondrial disorder. And this interjected the whole notion of the interplay between mitochondria and possibly vaccines and the cause of autism. So it's kind of a complicated story, and we've been fighting it out on Neurologica and then Science-Based Medicine. And then he wrote an open letter to me on Age of Autism. David Kirby sort of called me out on the Huffington Post. It's been a lot of fun, actually, you know, going at it with those guys. So I recommend that you read them if you're interested in this story, because we go into a lot of detail. But a lot of it hinges on this whole notion of celebrity spokespersons and what their proper role should be. And, you know, the anti-vaccinations are a little hypocritical in attacking Amanda Peet when they haven't been holding Jenny McCarthy to the same standard. I mean, she's like out and out lying to the public. That's okay, though, because she's a mom.
Yeah, she's a anti-freeze.
She's the mommy defense, which I hate.
Oh, yeah, the mommy defense. Mommy's instinct. Yeah.
Just complete non sequitur.
Yeah, that beats any science I know.
The other celebrity who decided to interject their opinion into the whole autism debate, although this was at the other end of the spectrum, was Michael Savage, who is a Evan. He's a it's appropriate to characterize him as a conservative.
Absolutely,
he's a neocon.
That's exactly right. He's a conservative radio talk show host.
Right.
Who's you know, got a pretty decent sized audience, about 6 million.
Six million listeners
a week, yeah.
So he said that 99% of kids with autism are just brats whose parents don't discipline them. That's some paraphrasing, but that he used the term brat and said that 99% of it's fake, basically. I mean,
solves that problem.
He's a shock jock.
Yeah, but
I think he really believes that.
Oh, yeah, I'm not saying, I'm not condoning him. I'm just saying that he's an idiot. Most people know he's an idiot, I should hope.
Yeah, but that's,
it's not
that's
really
old
surprise.
School ignorance.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
just like yeah, the cranky old man. Ah, there's autism. Yeah. It's all bratty kids. Right. I mean, that's like something from the 50s, you know? It really is. I mean,
it's exactly shocking.
Yeah. It's shocking, all right.
I thought we were beyond at least that level.
Yeah, yeah. So... it was telling. He got a lot of flack for that, and then he the following show he kind of backpedaled, but he really, I thought, very deceptively tried to defend himself by saying, what I really meant was I'm very much in favor of these kids, and I don't want any resources being taken away from them by those parents who are faking it to get like disability and to get services. It's like, no, that's not what you said. You said 99% is fake, you know, and that it's just bratty kids. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a lame defense. And he used a lot of arguments that sound a lot like what I call mental illness denial, like saying that there's no objective test for it. It's based upon, you know, clinical features. Well, yeah, so are migraines. You know, it doesn't mean they're not real. I mean, autism, there's so much basic neurological science behind it. The notion that it's some kind of soft diagnosis is just absurd.
But, you know, Savage does have a bit of a quote-unquote medical background. He is a homeopath. He's written books on homeopathy.
Books.
Has he?
Yep.
I didn't even realize that. I hated him even though I didn't know that.
With
He's wrote a bunch of books on alternative medicine type woo stuff. Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yep. Before he got into radio, that's what he did.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know.
My goodness. Leave the science to the scientists.
Please.
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 James von Prague has put himself back in the news recently. I guess he's got a new book out and got on The View to push his book. So James von Prague is a medium and alleged psychic who talks to the dead.
A cold reader.
Yeah, he's basically a cold reader who talks to the loved ones of the recently departed.
You know, I talk to the dead, too. It's just that they never answer me.
Right. I like to think of it as charades with the dead. That's what it looks like more to me.
Yeah.
He was kind of eclipsed by John Edwards, though.
Yeah, I think it's the weird pedo mustache and the hair. Yeah, oof. I think Edward kind of beat him out on that. I mean, He's really, like, Edward is pretty skeezy, but von Prague takes the oily used car salesman act to a whole new level.
Douchebag by any other name.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's cool. And yes, everyone, that was a personal attack. So you can write that down in your
what the pedo mustache
logical fallacy book. Yeah,
no, we're not saying that.
But that's not why he's wrong.
He's not saying he's wrong and the psychics are not real because he's a douchebag. We're saying
he's
that,
wrong and also
he's a
douchebag with a pedo mustache.
So get this. So after the day after he was on, Barbara Walters tells this story. He says, after the interview, and when the interview was over, so the cameras weren't on, von Prague came up to her and said, can I talk to you for a minute? She's like, oh, yeah, sure, you know, just we can talk. And he said, I see your energy that, you know, because of your energy that you have problems with your lower back and with your blood. And Barbara Walters, who, you know, actually reacted in a quite skeptical and savvy way, said, you know, who doesn't have lower back problems? I mean, you know, you go up to a 70-year-old woman, or I don't know how old she is, but she's an old, you know, older woman, so you have lower back problems. Mm-hmm. Talk about your high probability hit.
Plus, that's true. Plus, it's also, I think, pretty well known that when she was younger, she had, I think, some major, I think she had to wear a brace and stuff, so she had some major sort of problems in that. I think it was with her lower back, and that's that's out there. That's well known. So
right. So either it was a hot read, he knew that, or it was just a really high probability cold read. But then he followed up the blood thing by saying that your white cells are elevated.
A specific claim.
Very specific. It's one of those
white
deceptively specific claims. That's right.
Mm.
So Barbara Walters said, this is crap, but let me go to my doctor and check it out anyway. And they did blood tests, and everything was normal. Her white count was normal. Everything was normal. So she was talking about like what a prick von Prague was for talking to her, making her worry about her health when it was
good
all just
her.
A shtick. You know?
Although she didn't use that word.
No, she didn't. But that's what she said. That, listen, he was doing this shtick on me. I mean, that's a terrible thing to do to make somebody worry about their health.
Yeah.
Let me tell you about the white blood cell thing for a second. So this is how you know that guys like Prague and Edward are consciously you know, doing what they're doing. This is cold reading. White cells are frequently elevated above the normal range for no specific reason. There's a lot of variability in the white cell count. You could have the sniffles and your white cell count will go up, or it could just be high. I mean, you know, I look at blood tests, blood panels every day. You know, half the time the white cells are a little elevated, and who cares? You don't pay that much attention. It's the kind of thing that in isolation you don't pay that much attention to it. So again, it's kind of a high probability hit. You know, it's one of those things that you might think naively if you weren't a physician, you would, or you're not used to looking at blood work, you would think, wow, that was really specific. And look, it was elevated. And right. That would be very impressive. But, you know, to somebody who's in the know, you realize that that's a really nonspecific, very high probability hit. You know, so that is, that's exactly the kind of trick that mentalists use.
Yep.
Exactly. And it's a totally scumbag thing to do because it's, you know, again, as Walter's correctly observed, because you're scaring somebody about their health, you know.
Right. So not only is he a con man, he's also unlucky.
Well, at least in that case.
Now, do you think this might be like, because I have not known Van Prague to make specific claims about the state of a person, of a healthy person before or whatever, just make any kind of technically a health claim. Do you think he's trying to try a new approach, maybe to recapture some of his maybe faded past glory, and try this new shtick out and try to see if how far he can take it and try?
Well, you know, he's probably done the health claim thing before.
Yeah, but we seen it much on TV and other places? Not that I've seen.
No, he's been primarily a medium, but it's all cold reading.
That's the thing. It's all lumped in with the same stuff, and you know, if one's not working and he can switch to another, it's not that big of a deal. I always wonder, you know, how much they think about whether or not they'll be held accountable for something that's being filmed when they make medical claims. I know Sylvia Brown gets away with it far too often. I feel like she should probably be prosecuted in some way for giving out medical advice when she's not a doctor.
Yeah. They used to do that. You know, imagine the good old days when people would get prosecuted for practicing medicine without a license. It almost never happened.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the good old days, she'd be, you know, crushed to death under stones as a witch. But
the good old days.
That was a little joke.
We're not being serious there. This is what I suspect with this episode. I think that his calculation was that he would give her this little cold read about her back and the blood count. If it missed, he lost nothing. It was off camera. He wasn't committing himself to anything on camera.
That's true.
If he hit and she bought it, then the next day she would be amazed how he did this. He would get another day of free promotion out of The View in a very positive, glowing light.
Absolutely.
So it was kind of a very low risk, very possibly high yield thing to do. But it backfired on him because Walters was just one notch too savvy for him.
She's spunky.
Plus, he got unlucky.
He was disappointed in Barbara's response to his failed.
And her misinterpretation of his...
she didn't misinterpret anything. Yeah,
That's what he claimed, that she's misinterpreting him. Okay.
Yeah, because, you know, high white blood cells, that's so easy to misinterpret.
If Jay were here, Jay has the night off, but if Jay were here, he would say that Von Prague said, what she said was very, very hurtful and mean and nasty, which is actually what he said.
That was a good impression of Jay doing an impression.
Yeah, thank you. One last quick news item, because, again, our inboxes were flooded with this one. It is kind of funny. We talk a lot about pareidolia, a lot of, you know, Jesus or Mary sightings on toast or tree bark or whatever. Well, this is the first time I've seen one on the Muslim end of things. I guess that's because you're not supposed to have an image of Muhammad. So I guess
but that's not true. There was a Muslim one just a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Denmark, there's been cartoons recently
thing is, so this is Allah meat. It's meat that people say meat which looks moldy and gross and weird. I guess it's gristle or something.
They said it called it gristle.
Yeah, and it spells out the name of Allah. And the thing is, this has happened before, and you're right in that it doesn't happen with Muhammad because nobody knows what Muhammad looks like. Because
you're not supposed to.
Not supposed to.
So this is writing. This was like the Arabic writing.
Right. So they go with the writing of Allah, which, you know, like most just regular words, it's like a bunch of squiggles and stuff. So, yeah.
To us, of course, it looks like a bunch of squiggles. But
no, I'm saying like any word. Any word is just a bunch of squiggles when you think about it. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, of course.
They did show it side by side, and it's like pareidolia. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. It looks like a W with something on the right side of it. And if you look at the word in Arabic, there's supposed to be a line on the right which really isn't there. So it has the same kind of pseudo close-ish match that pareidolia of Jesus or Mary has in other contexts. So it's just coincidence. Although they said there were three different pieces of meat that had the same writing on it, which makes me think that
somebody's got an Allah stamp.
Well, there was a template somewhere. Again, not necessarily deliberate, but it was off of a grill or something. It does kind of look like a grillish pattern if you look at it.
Yeah.
That's an easy enough explanation for that. But some Islamic scholars were consulted to help us interpret this, and they said they all commented that it was a sign to show that Islam is the only true religion for mankind.
It's obvious. Like, if Allah wants to let us know that it's just him and only him, I mean, obviously he's going to stamp his name on a piece of crystal in Nigeria.
Right.
Just makes sense.
There it is.
Duh.
Yeah, if I wanted to convince the world of what the one true religion were and I were all powerful, that's exactly what I would do.
That's why I keep carving my name into desks. Just to let people know.
I like how they consulted some doctor. Why would they be able to interpret this? And he said, given the circumstances, there is no explanation.
Yep.
He's not a doctor. He's a veterinarian.
Well, he's got doctor in front of his name, Dr. Yuck.
Yeah, but let's be clear. He's a veterinarian.
He's a veterinary doctor.
That's a doctor.
Not a medical doctor. Just as smart as anybody else, but it's just... That for some reason that's
well,
me
it's
is
not like
funnier.
This is a piece of human flesh, you know. It's a piece of animal.
That's true.
So you bring
it's
in the vet
meat.
To talk
so they,
about
that's
it.
That's a good point, exactly. Evan. But the point is, there is no doctor of anything that's qualified to interpret this.
There's no doctor of Allah meat?
Unless you're a doctor of
psychology. How about
doctor
psychology?
Of religious...
Or psychology. They should have called Richard Wiseman in.
Yeah, there you go.
A doctor of pareidolia.
Or a doctor of tattooology.
Pareidolologist. Doctor.
Hey, I'm going to start calling myself. I'm a pareidoliologist. That's awesome.
There you go.
I'm Dr. Stephen Novella, pareidoliologist.
And everyone
haven't
will be
I
like,
seen you before?
Ooh,
no, I get that a lot.
Impressive.
I get that. I like that.
Thank you. I'll be here all week.
Try the veal. Oh, wait.
Tip
no.
Your
try the gristle.
Try the olive.
Try the gristle. Let's go on to some questions and email. First question comes from Paul Schenker from Arizona, United States, and he writes, "Hi, I'm a big fan of your show, and while I know this doesn't necessarily have to do with skeptic inquiry, the rogue's perspective on science I take as authoritative due to the simplicity with which you describe complex topics, something that is very important because I likely wouldn't be able to understand these topics otherwise."
You and me both, brother. Yeah, right.
That's good. So we're authoritative because we're simple. That's good. "Therefore, I want to ask a few questions. What is chaos? What is its relationship to science? What is its relationship to organization? Is this a pseudoscience? If it isn't, doesn't chaos appear within order, or is order created within chaos? Your views on this would further my education. Thank you for your time."
We're going to need another 2 hours.
Chaos is an organization dedicated to the evil takeover of the world.
That's
and they
Maxwell
are opposed by a secret spy agency called Control.
Control.
Now, Steve, that,
I'm
come
learning.
On,
go ahead.
Don't be silly. That's chaos with a K.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Well,
I figured you just spelled it wrong. But assuming that maybe you're talking about chaos theory, then I have a slightly different answer for you. Bob, why don't you go ahead and take it away.
I've always had an interest in chaos theory. It's actually been a little bit of a while since I've been doing a lot of reading on it, but I was always extremely interested in it. And one key thing that we need to discuss at first, though, is that the word chaos is kind of like the word theory itself, in that common usage is different from the more precise way it's used in science. In common parlance, chaos means utter confusion or disorder, but it doesn't really mean that in chaos theory, which describes the behavior of certain types of dynamical systems that change over time. An example is, a three-body astronomical system that's bound by gravity. That was the very first system where chaotic behavior was actually detected by Poincaré.
And that befuddled Isaac Newton. He gave up on the three-body problem.
Was he befuddled or baffled or perplexed?
Bewildered.
No, he was befuddled.
I think it was all three.
But, and Bob, at its core, chaos theory is really a mathematical discipline, right?
Well, yes, absolutely. And that kind of ties into his question of is it a pseudoscience? I'm not sure where that's coming from.
Maybe just because you hear about it in the popular press, so you got to wonder if it's
real
or not.
Yeah, and I think it ties into a lot of the questions from this email, and especially the question where it says, what's its relationship to science? Well, its relationship is that it's a branch of mathematics, which is, it's
science.
It's science that as I said, describes the way certain types of dynamical systems change over time. So it is science. I mean, there's really, it's not some little fringe thing that people are talking about. This is pretty solid stuff. And one I can't really talk about chaos theory, though, without talking about one of the hallmarks of chaos theory is the so-called sensitive dependence to initial conditions.
And that describes a system, right? That's not describing chaos theory. That's describing a system in which these chaotic effects are dominant. There's this...
Right.
The properties of such systems is that they have a very sensitive dependence on initial conditions. Wait.
Right, which means that their initial state is so... I don't know if I want to use the word fragile, but it's so specific that if you were to simulate a truly chaotic system and you ran a simulation of say the weather, and if you changed your initial conditions by just the tiniest, one in one trillionth amount, your end result would be completely different. So
that's because very subtle changes are magnified through multiple complex interactions.
Right. The errors basically double over time, and eventually the errors get so big that it swallows your entire simulation, making any prediction you want to make essentially random. The common expression of this is the butterfly effect, as it applies to weather prediction. It's so sensitive that a butterfly in Texas flapping its wings could cause a tornado on the other side of the world a year later type of thing. I mean, that's how exquisitely accurate you'd have to be. You'd have to account for a butterfly flapping its wings in order to predict that tornado on the other side of the planet a year later.
And that's why we'll never be able to predict the weather beyond a certain number of days.
Because you cannot have infinite precision, then you cannot predict beyond short term any chaotic system. It's impossible. So right. even in a billion years, with full-blown mature nanotechnology and singularity in full swing, we're not going to be able to predict with high accuracy, what the weather's going to be like in a week if we don't have weather control.
Well, right, weather control, I was going to bring that up, Bob. That would be a way of sort of cheating the system.
His last question actually was interesting. It was a good question, and it really got me thinking, and it took me a little while to realize what the answer was. Does chaos appear within order, or is order created within chaos? And I kind of could think of a reason to support each one of those ideas
at
first.
Both.
And then I hit upon an interesting way to approach it. I typed in Google, order from chaos, and I got 164,000 hits. And I typed in chaos from order, and I got 2,000 hits. So
no,
I was thinking, maybe it's the first one. But then it hit me that it's a false premise. That question itself stems from the colloquial definition of chaos, that it's random and crazy, but chaotic systems are not random. They are deterministic. They are completely specified from their initial conditions. It's just that we can never, in principle, know what those initial conditions are.
But I also interpret that a little bit different too. I thought order from chaos is like the relationship between weather and climate. climate we can predict.
Right.
That is a large-scale order that emerges from the finer chaos that we can't predict. So I can't know it's going to rain 43 days from now, but I can know that it's going to get colder as the winter comes upon us.
Right, and that actually ties in nicely to another concept of chaos theory, and that's what a strange attractor is, which is basically the shape. If you had to put a shape around a chaotic system and what the bounds, the limits of what that chaotic system can do, it's called this shape, which is a strange attractor. And surprisingly, the strange attractor for weather is this really beautiful, very complicated fractal shape that looks like a butterfly. And so it was really ironic that it had that shape. But you're right, Steve. That ties into that whole idea of a strange attractor, and I was going to bring that up until I realized that the question was kind of a false premise. It was stemming from a false premise.
Bob, is there one book you would recommend for our readers to delve deep into this? Is it The Butterfly Effect?
There's a lot of them. I would go to some good science websites for some primers on chaos theory. The book by Gleick on chaos theory was one of the seminal books on it. Also, the early Mandelbrot book on fractals and things. But the Gleick book on chaos was seminal. I'd go with that.
Well, let's go on to our interview. We have an interview that we recorded at TAM with George Hreb, who is a skeptical musician and a very cool
Love
guy.
George.
I mean, I have to say, when we were at TAM, George stood out from across the room.
Huh.
He was
just his cool suit.
Thin guy.
He's a sexy mofo.
Bald. One point, he had his girlfriend with him, and he had his guitar slung over his back. Absolutely impeccable suit. And he looked like a movie star, and just kind of stood out in the skeptical crowd. Not that it wasn't a good looking crowd; it was just he had a style. He had definitely had a style all his own that definitely stood out. Well, anyway, let's go on to our interview. Well, we are sitting here now at TAM 6 with George Hreb. George, welcome to the Skeptics Guide.
Nice to be here. Nice to see everybody. Thanks so much for talking.
Good to see you.
Good to
you
see
know,
him.
You are a dapper fellow. I have to say that you're one of the best dressed skeptics.
Oh, well,
here.
Yes, but that's kind of like saying I'm the smartest drummer. Not exactly that.
World's tallest midget.
Exactly. not the best.
Skinniest kid at
no,
Fat
Camp. Right.
So, George, you are a skeptical performer.
Yes.
An author and podcaster.
Yes, yes.
Tell us a little bit about what you do.
I'm a musician by trade. My day job, I call it, is playing drums for the Philadelphia Funk Authority, which is a 9-piece funk band out of Philadelphia. We play corporate things, festivals, private events. The most fun you can have playing music is it's all 70s soul, R&B. Yeah,
that's my favorite.
It's, James Brown, Earth, Wind & Fire, Stevie Wonder, all that fun stuff. That's my day job.
Yeah.
That's what I do going to work. In my spare time, when I'm not doing that, I write music. I've recorded 5 albums. I wrote one little silly book. And every week I do a podcast called The Geologic. There's this thing called podcasting. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys heard about this.
That sounds interesting.
Really cool. You should check
Flash
it out.
In the pan.
Tell us about your show.
It's sort of a collection of silliness. And a few years back in college, I had done a radio show because I think that's the rule. When you're in college, you have to do at least one radio program. I did that, and it was sort of a talk show mixture weirdness thing. And Lehigh University, which is – I live in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Lehigh University has a community radio program. In the summer, local community people can do programs. And a fan of mine, a guy who had seen me perform my own material, said, you should do a show, figuring I would do a music show. I thought, instead of a music show, which everybody else does, why don't I do something like what I did in college, which would be – sketches and observations and stuff. So I kind of did that. That ended up being like a laboratory for what the Geologic Podcast would become. The bits that worked or didn't work got kind of coalesced from the 3 hours once a week down to the 45 minutes to an hour once a week. Now the show is a combination of sort of me doing crappy versions of Stan Freberg sketches, sort of my modern reinterpretations. There's skeptical material. There's what it's like to play in a nine-piece funk band, what it's like to deal with brides and brides' mothers, stories, you know, road stories. And then just, I mean, I have a thing called Interesting Fauna, which people send me in if they find some cool animal that's got some bizarre facts about it. I just talk about that. There's a section called Gio's Mom Reads Jay-Z Lyrics. My mom calls in and she reads Jay-Z lyrics to me.
That is hysterical.
And then we just talk. It's basically an excuse for us to BS, you know, for like 5-10 minutes. But it's a nice little hook. There's the Religious Moron of the Week, which is probably the most popular segment that I do. I every day probably get 10 to 15 emails from around the world, literally, of people sending me religious morons, and which can be of any stripe.
Thing. You don't discriminate.
No, idiots are the target, which is nice. Idiots are kind of it's a pan target, so it's nice.
Right.
That's probably the most popular bit that I do, and it's things like that. You know, it's and what's nice is it utilizes or at least it takes advantage of sort of every artistic part of my or creative part of my head. You know, which is only like a square centimeter, but to be able to do comedy stuff and write songs and then do the sort of atheist skeptical stuff and then to format it and use the technical part of my head to try to make it seem okay and produce the stuff and all the stuff that you guys do every week, you know, it's really pushes you to be as creative as you can be constantly. And it's so rewarding. It's like doing a little miniature record every week. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've done 5 records in 10 years. So it's, you know, averages out to what? 1 every 3 years. I'm not good at math.
Something like that. Yeah.
Anyway, which is so rewarding, but there's such a huge span between the production and when the stuff comes out and the people's response to it. Here, every week, you know, Wednesday night, like you guys know, you do it, and you know, a day goes by, and then you get responses right away, and it's such a satisfying creative process.
Yeah, and you do such a fantastic job. I love your podcast.
Thank you.
And your music. You know, when I heard Brains, Body, Both.
There you go.
Fantastic. Cool. Like, you know, just skeptical anthems. Yeah. It was.
Yes.
I'm like, he knows me.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I wrote the song Skeptic and I started it, like I said yesterday in my performance, I think about 12 years ago. I wrote the first 2 verses after reading Shermer's, Why People Believe Weird Things. Mm-hmm. You know, I read this book. I was in London with a friend of mine and, was waiting for him to come and I had my little notebook and I just started writing kind of the first verses of it. And to think, you know, 12 years later, you know, I'm getting handed a little plaque from the James Randi Foundation, you know, thanking me for being part of their meeting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, again, for someone who doesn't profess to believe in some kind of fate or deity, you know, the guiding hand, it's pretty friggin' cool.
You know,
and I'm so unbelievably grateful and appreciative that, you know, folks like you make this kind of thing possible, and it's really, really cool.
Well, you know, I just think we need more people like you who, you know, I think we have a lot of scientists and engineers and those sort of people in the skeptical
like
community.
Me,
we need the idiots.
I'm volunteering. Yes.
We need the artists.
You
know, we need the artists. Yeah. We need the creative thinkers because not everybody is going to be picking up Skeptical Inquirer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But, you know, they are watching YouTube and.
Yeah. I mean, you have to bring it into the culture more. You know,
you look at the popularity of Mythbusters, you know, is just, I remember first seeing the show Mythbusters. I think it was like a pilot episode that they ran at 3 a.m. on a Tuesday, which is my prime time.
Yeah.
Because I'm always up, you know, at that time. And I remember seeing this show and thinking, this is the coolest show I have ever seen. And there is no way they're going to run this thing.
Yeah.
Like this will be 2 episodes and it'll stop because it's too smart.
Yeah.
The methodology is too well done. There's not, you know, these guys, they're not TV guys. They're not, hey, we're going to explode stuff. This is great. Yeah. You know, which every subsequent pseudo Mythbusters show is.
Right.
It just makes me want to vomit.
Yeah.
You know, if you can get outside the kind of cookie cutter idea of what's supposed to be entertaining, what's supposed to be your host, you know, that annoying Seacrest phenomenon, people think, oh, that's what you want for a host. And it's like, no, you want a human being who's interested in what they do. And you don't have to be, you can be, you know, this walrus type person like he is. And that's enough, you know, because you see how interested he is in the results and what's going on. Those kind of people, you know, Graydon Square, I did a show with him yesterday, who's, I don't know you know, the hip hop skeptical, I mean, talk about a niche.
Yeah, who knew that was going to work? Yeah. Right.
And it's just, you know, if you wanted Orange Ruffy 30 years ago, or if you wanted sushi 20 years ago, you wouldn't have found it in a supermarket.
Yeah.
You know, all of those interesting foods that are so delicious and amazing and, you know, culturally maybe, again, fit some kind of niche that weren't exposed. But somehow through the global market, these foods slowly got exposed and the palate of the American consumer expanded.
Yeah.
So now almost every kind of mega market has a little sushi section,
yep.
which is mind-boggling. You know, when you think, hell, 10 years ago, you wouldn't have even
There are some places yet, you, know? You really shouldn't eat that
Yeah,
sushi
my first thing. Reaction right. when I saw yeah. sushi in a supermarket was, oh, no, no. No.
Right,
but,
right.
But then you try it eventually.
Yeah, but then you like, wander in at midnight yeah. drunk and you say, that's
actually no, right. I mean, I'm a Wegmans freak. I don't know if you guys know Wegmans. I mean, it's sort of a Northeast thing, and they have an amazing sushi section, you know. But I'm always struck that, okay, if I want to find some kind of Ethiopian flatbread, you know, I might be able to,
yeah.
you know, mm-hmm. as compared to 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think it's the same exact thing that can be relayed to entertainment mm-hmm. or skeptical programming or things like that, that people don't know what they like or
That's
what
right.
they could like.
Right.
And if they could just get a taste by, you know, you initially have, again, to drive the sushi metaphor into the ground, but you have that initial little place that serves sushi somewhere and they have their loyal following that then bring friends in, and it kind of spreads out and you get that, you know, sushi critical mass, you know, and which is what I think we're heading towards.
Yeah.
Again, you see, like, I think Shermer said this yesterday, you look at, you know, you go to Borders or Barnes & Noble and for the first time you have an atheist section.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like, yay.
Yeah.
You know, I used to stand in front of the spiritualism section, which was, you know, 30 feet long.
Right.
And the science section that was 6 feet long and just cry.
I know. Yeah. I judge yes. bookstores by their
Right. You know, yes. and hey, yes. whatever sells, you
it's
can't blame them. Yeah. You know, but okay. It's slowly going. And you see if people are exposed to it. I mean, and it's everything. It's, I think it's the same experience that we all went through at some point, whether it was 10, 15, 20 years ago when I found Shermer's book, you know, mm-hmm. 12 years ago and thought, oh, this is like, a movement.
Yeah, there's something
of,
yeah. actually out
this.
There. Yeah.
yeah, it's like, yeah. look what exists that I had no idea
yeah,
about.
There's yeah, there's other people that sort of think the same thing. And to walk in the halls here and see everybody with these blue badges that yeah. we all have to wear.
Oh, yeah.
And that you can, I mean, it struck me Thursday as I was walking, I felt like a trout. I was walking against the tide because I was trying to get to the last mm-hmm. little bit of coffee that they had still at the breakfast. And everybody's going towards the main thing. And it just struck me. I said, there's almost 1,000 people here that philosophically are we probably agree 90%.
Yeah.
You know, which just never happens. You know, you
and
walk
we're
into
from
a
all
room,
over the world too.
That's the
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm meeting people from Holland and from Australia and Japan and it's so encouraging.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's still a pretty small sample in terms of 1,000 people.
But we're in the right direction.
This,
I mean,
but yeah. we're in the right direction. Yeah.
yeah. You know, the interesting thing about when I come to TAM is this is my second year. I find that everybody basically, like you said, there's a commonality in the thinking. Everybody is really friendly, very, very much
yes.
into learning. You know, there are common things here that I'm actually really surprised. You know, and you'd figure there'd be much more of a variety in 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
But the attitude, the overall attitude is, let's learn, let's talk to each other,
right.
let's have a good time.
Right.
And I'll say it again, we were talking earlier, I'm really, really wished I caught the show last night. Tell us where we can hear your music. Tell us where we can see your website.
Sure. If you go to geologicpodcast.com, that's my weekly show. Also, georgehrab.com. It's H-R-A-B. And all my albums are available on iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
You can also go to cdbaby.com if you want the actual physical album. What I kind of pride myself on is my physical albums are sort of events in of themselves.
They're gorgeous.
In this age of digital downloads, to encourage someone to buy an actual physical CD, I think it has to be a little bit extra
yeah.
special.
Yeah, right,
so
yeah.
packaging to me is real important. In the last record, in Terrabang, it comes with a 26-page booklet. In the middle, there's an essay about the theory of relativity
yep.
and how the theory of relativity just kills me. And
Phil Plays trying to yes. spot yet another, you know.
Yes. Thank you for noticing that, Philip.
Just because your interview got crashed doesn't mean you have to do it.
No, crash away. crash away.
George, what's your favorite thing that you do now? Like, is it the podcasting? It sounded like it.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. I mean, it's what I'm doing at the time. I mean, last night I could have done a 7-hour show.
Yeah.
Because it was just exactly.
And people probably would have stayed for a 7-hour show.
You get the butt numbing entertainment. But I just, when I'm in the moment and when that Kandinsky idea of flow happens.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, and I'm so lucky that I have so many venues to flow.
Yeah.
Sounds like a tampon commercial.
heavy flow.
Which is awful. Yes, yes. I appreciate my flow, even on the beach.
Own it.
So my favorite thing is what I'm doing at the moment. You know, if I'm playing drums with a funk band and we're doing I Wish by Stevie Wonder, I want to do that all night.
Yeah. yeah.
You know, whereas, I mean, if I'm being interviewed by smart people that are asking good questions, I want to do that all day.
Yeah.
So it's what I'm doing in the moment, and I'm very fortunate that I can do all those things.
You know what's okay. weird about the internet is, like with video games and just searching the web and everything, there's a lot of people just spending time alone on their computers. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's a lot of people connecting to a lot of people on the internet. I mean, mm-hmm. and I find that to be wonderful about the internet. I mean, we really do connect. I think we connect in more ways. And it may not be as intimate as sitting around the kitchen table with your family or whatever, but we get to talk to people from all over the world.
And yet, in ways, it's almost more intimate. I mean, there are, if you think that, you know, I've done 70 shows, which is about 70 hours of material, that you can sort of literally be in my brain for 70 hours. If
it's
you
a fun place to be.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully it's scary or whatever, terrifying.
I think there's a movie there, being George Rapp.
But that, and that's why when you do see that person standing 15 feet away, I mean, they know you, but they don't know
you. And
you
don't know them.
Right? And it's such a one-way thing, which is such a fascinating thing. I mean, because I tell very personal stories. I mean, I completely tell, you know, very, very personal stuff sometimes that, for me, it's the same way that songs are therapeutic for me. You know, if someone upsets me or something, I see something that is very frustrating, I try to channel it, write a song, and then I can kind of deal with it. The show deals the same way, and I try to keep it as entertaining as possible and not get too maudlin. But the biggest responses I've had have been to personal crises. I mean, mm-hmm. I wrote a song about losing my dog, you know, that died a couple of years, and it was a year anniversary. He died before I started the show. And at the year anniversary, I played this song. Oh, the response I got to this, you know, because it was a real moment, whatever you want to call it.
And in the traditional world of people writing music and people buying albums and everything, it would never happen that way.
Oh, no.
You wouldn't get the feedback like that.
No, it would be on an album, and it would be 2 years later, and maybe someone at some point would come up and say, hey, I like that thing that you wrote 2 years ago. This was like, I had just finished this thing. It was, you know, and I thought, okay, here's a perfect chance. It's been a year for Oscar. I'm going to play this, you know, and then another friend of mine, she lost her boxer. I had a boxer. It was just the coolest.
Boxer's a nice dog.
Boxers are just the best. Mm-hmm. So she lost her boxer, so I played it again, and again, this flood of emails. So much so that even one listener, you know, whose mother was terminal, asked if he could play it at you know her funeral, you know, because it deals with this idea of as non-believers, how do we deal with loss and what is comforting to us? It's very easy to say, hey, he's in puppy heaven, you know, and to kind of comfort yourself with that. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want that kind of to sink in and for me to even imagine that, you know, Oscar's in a better place. And I thought, what is the thing that I can latch onto? And the thing I latched onto, which then, I mean, I couldn't write this song for probably 9 months. I just couldn't find the angle apart from saying, you know, I miss you. And what I figured out was this idea that the only positive thing in not having this afterlife and losing a loved one, not the only, but one thing I could latch onto was that they don't get to miss us.
Yeah.
Huh. That when he's gone, his final moment of sort of being tired and going to sleep is his eternity. He thinks he's going to wake up and go for a walk.
Yeah.
You know, we have to deal with the shit. We have to deal with the pain and whatever. And that's, and I would much rather have it be on me, you know, and then this idea that, as you lose a loved one, we get to miss them, but they don't get to miss us.
I just lost my cat 2 weeks ago.
Okay, so you know,
I'm so bummed out right now.
This took a turn for them. But that's the thing, though. You know,
I can't believe I'm crying.
No, man, I'm right there with you. I'm right there with you because I start talking about this stuff, and I'm right there with you. And I try to play this tune, you know, and it's I'm right there with you, brother. I'm right there with you. But that's what we have to hang on to. And you know, it's kind of like an atheist in a foxhole moment where it's like, damn it, no, I'm not gonna succumb and think to, you know, and sort of silently say to myself, someone take care of this creature.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, no, fuck it. No, damn it. This is what I believe. And this is when you prove yourself.
Yeah.
It's very easy to say, you know, to be cynical or not cynical, but to be, you know, a non-believer in moments of pleasure.
Right.
But when we lose loved ones, you know, to be able to say, yeah, this is so completely unfair.
Yeah.
Right.
But damn it, you know, this is the deal.
Yeah,
and at least, you know, she can't miss you.
Yeah.
You know,
we went through this with Perry last year, and we are coming up on his 1 year anniversary of his parting. And, boy, it's just, you know, every day we think about it. Yeah. He is never, and he never will be.
Right.
Perry was one of the rogues.
Yeah.
It was, you know, losing Perry was, it's so big. It was such a big blow because he was only 42 years old.
Oh, goodness. Yeah.
You know, Perry knew that he had like 10 years to go, right, Steve? Like the doctor told him.
It was actually funny. Like 8 years before he died, he was told, you got about 8 years, you know, with average life expectancy.
Oh, so it was 8 years. It wasn't 10 years?
Yeah, I think it was 8 years with scleroderma. Yeah. Said that's the average life expectancy from the point of diagnosis, and it was pretty accurate in retrospect.
Pendulette was just talking about loss as an atheist mm-hmm. as well, because when he lost his mother, I mean, he was destroyed. And he said that when a fellow atheist loses someone close, what he tends to say, and I forget his exact words, but it was something along the lines of, this is going to hurt like hell.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
this is
yeah,
the
yeah.
worst feeling you in the world.
Absolutely.
And she's gone.
And it shows the value of that person.
Right.
I was astounded. I don't want to say astounded, but I was shocked by how affected I was by losing Oscar.
Yeah.
And pleased by it too, that this kind of crusty musician asshole that I am could feel this much for something.
You have to have, you know, if you don't have the spectrum, and this is one thing that bothers me about religion and about not facing your own mortality. Like just putting that buffer of, well, I'm probably going to be okay and God loves me and everything.
Right.
I think one of the most profound time periods of my life was when I really had to say, that's it. I'm going to expire. It's going to be over. And it gave me much more of an appreciation. And
that's the thing.
Yeah. It turned into my life is I just throw myself on top of people. Like I don't waste the time. But I want to know people intimately.
Yeah.
I want them to know how I feel. I don't have that barrier. Isn't there for me.
I have a line in the song is, I have no need for heaven or some eternal bluff. I prefer what's real, and what we've had here is enough.
Here's another great.
That's enough.
Awesome.
Why do you need clouds, you know, hopping around with wings on your back? Like, this is real, and it should be enough.
Another great thing about podcasting, and we know this through our experience with Perry, is, you know, in a podcast, now you're immortal now. I mean, there are 110
Absolutely.
Episodes now of our podcast out there that have Perry, and that people can now, who never knew him, and years from now, they'll still be able to know.
Oh,
it is a sort of an immortality.
That is something that I like. It was just my dad's 65th birthday, Father's Day. He was 65. We had a big party for him. And I did this sort of presentation where I had people from his past calling. It was all joke stuff.
Yeah.
Just me pretending to be, you know, his first gym teacher, his first camp counselor, things like that. And I wanted to sort of immortalize it. So I put it on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, in a way, it's in a vault and there it is. And sort of
That's
it's there
fantastic.
Forever.
That's
and as
right.
things
yeah.
happen, you can kind of immortalize them through this medium. And it's amazing.
Yeah. The digital immortality, you know, quote unquote, is interesting and is useful, but there's also just your influence on people.
Yeah.
You know, the people
Absolutely.
That we influence will go on with their lives and they'll influence other people's.
Yeah.
We've made a ripple in the pond that will never, you know, fully go out.
That meme, kind of that personal meme that you can spread,
right.
you know, hopefully.
Right. And George, and I think that you can be particularly proud of, you know, your the legacy that you've left thus far, and I can't wait to see
That's
what's coming
kind.
Next.
What is coming next? What's coming next?
Is there an album? Is there another album?
Yes, album number six. My good friend Slough, who's my engineer out of Astoria, Queens, B-Sharp Studio, he said, all right, it's time. Let's go. What's the plan? I have just about 80% of it written. The last 20% usually is the deadline writing. Gotta finish, let's go, okay, which I need. So I think I'm going to record probably August, September, and hopefully with the new year, if not before then, we'll have album number six.
I can't Excellent. Wait. We'll Excellent. Have to have you on again when it's coming out.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Please.
Plug the hell out of that.
Sure.
George, this was great. Thank you for sitting
Thank
with
you
us.
So much, guys. I really appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you,
George.
George.
Thank
Pleasure.
You.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake. Then I challenge my skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready?
Yes.
Item number one. A new study shows that simply educating older patients about the benefits of regular exercise results in improved quality of life and significantly reduces the risk of heart disease. Item number two. For the first time, astronomers have imaged the accretion disk surrounding a black hole. And item number three, scientists have discovered a protein in human saliva that greatly speeds wound healing. Rebecca, go first.
Okay. I'm pretty sure that human saliva does speed up wound healing because I knew this kid in the third grade. He used to like lick his own cuts to gross us out, and it always seemed like it worked. I just wanted to tell that story for some reason. It was gross, and I suddenly remembered it. The accretion disk surrounding a black hole, I'm actually not 100% sure what that is.
It's the disk of stuff that a black hole is in the process of sucking in. It's a disk of material spiraling into the black hole.
Oh, okay. And for the first time, they imaged it? Yep. And a new study says that educating older patients about the benefits of regular exercise results in improved quality of life. Simply educating them. I think that sounds suspiciously common sense. I think that perhaps just educating older patients about the benefits of exercise doesn't necessarily have significant results. I think it might take more than that, like actually signing them into a course or something where they're actually moving. And yeah, I think that one sounds fishy to me. I'm going to say that that's not true.
Okay, Bob.
See, the protein in human saliva greatly speeds wound healing. Greatly? I mean, we've always heard that, right? About saliva and with dogs licking your wound, your a cut or something, or the accretion disk surrounding a black hole. The first time, well, I know the accretion disk, as the matter spirals down the drain of the black hole, it emits X-rays as it heats up. But we, and we've seen that before, but don't know about that one. Let's see. Yeah, the simply educating the elderly about the benefits of exercise significantly reduces the risk of heart disease. I mean, that's, are we supposed to swallow that? I mean, what kind of crap is that? I do know that that even very minor exercise by the elderly can work wonders. Like, I've read of some studies where they had these octogenarians doing, like, lifting weights. You know, it didn't matter that they were, like, 10-pound dumbbells, but they literally tripled their strength in just a small amount of time. And when you're that age, it can mean the difference between being able to, you know, carry the groceries in the house or, you know, sitting in a chair most of the day. So the benefits are huge. But just hearing about it, I mean, what the hell? How the hell are we supposed to buy that? So that's got to be fiction, I guess. Jeez.
Okay, Evan?
Right. I'm tending to agree, I think, with everybody else here. So the protein in human saliva speeding wound healing. Yeah, animals lick their wounds. And why should humans be any different than any other animal in that regard? So,
because we're not gross.
Imaging the accretion disk surrounding a black hole. The only thing about that one that puzzled me a little bit is, haven't we already imaged the accretion disk surrounding a black hole? Based on photographs and other things, you know, you've seen? Or are those just representations, or they're just measuring
dramatic recreations?
And, yeah, so simply educating older patients? No, because they need help. I mean, what are you going to do? You put a book in front of them and, here, read this, and then they're going to get up and go and do what they have to do. So I'm in agreement with everyone else.
Okay, so let's
reverse order.
We'll take them in reverse order. Yeah, why not? Scientists have discovered a protein in human saliva that greatly speeds wound healing, and that is science.
Yay,
science.
And yeah, that's not the first time that that observation was made about licking your wounds, but they actually...
Or just cuts, and not just licking wounds, but just cuts in the mouth,
like little
just
cuts.
Seem to heal faster.
Now, the question was it just a antibacterial effect? You know, just or was it actually something that was directly improving wound healing? And what they found is that it's both, but there is a protein that actually directly improves wound healing, and they isolated the protein. It's called histatin, H-I-S-T-A-T-I-N. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly.
And so in 10 years, we'll see some research come out to consumers for this, 20 years maybe.
Yeah, hopefully it won't take that long. But what they're saying is that this is the kind of stuff you could put in, like, bacitracin ointment. You know, you could put
or
it
a Band-Aid. How about a Band-Aid?
Yeah, you could put it in ointments and bandages and stuff like that. That will help the wound healing directly. Since it's topical, you know, then the fact that it's a protein is not a big deal. So, I think it'll take less time than that. Number two, for the first time, astronomers have imaged the accretion disk surrounding a black hole.
Uh-oh.
You all thought that was science. And that one was indeed science.
Yay for us.
Yeah. Now, Bob, you're right. We've seen X-ray bursts and things like that from the disk. And that is one of the theories about quasars, for example, that's very supermassive black holes inside galaxies because it's rotating, may produce, you know, these physical effects that result in things like the quasars and gamma rays and stuff. But we've never been able to actually image the accretion disk and see its spectrum.
Ah.
There are predictions about what the spectrum should look like if our current models are accurate. So they really wanted to be able to see the spectrum of an accretion disk so they could validate or invalidate our models. And they figured out a way to do this. What they did was they attached a polarizing filter to the United Kingdom infrared telescope on Mauna Kea in Hawaii. The reason why they did this was because the theories were that all the dust and everything around the black holes, the clouds of gas and dust, etc., also give off light, and they obscure the accretion disk. That's why we haven't been able to image its spectrum, because it's obscured by all the dust and gas clouds. But if the light given off by the accretion disk is polarized, then they can use a polarizing filter to separate it out from all the rest of the light. That's what they did, and it worked. And we were able to see, for the first time, image the spectrum of the accretion disk around a black hole. Pretty cool.
Cool.
And it did validate their model. Yeah. So, once again, science gets it right.
Yay, science.
Validation's all good, but sometimes you don't want to be validated. Like, oh, new science.
It's a balance. If you're always wrong, then you're not building anything. You gotta,
right.
You want to build, but also every now and then be surprised and show you new angles for a new discovery. So it's a good balance. It's a good balance, I think. All of which means that, number one, a new study shows that simply educating older patients about the benefits of regular exercise results in improved quality of life and significantly reduces the risk of heart disease is fiction. And you guys all zeroed in on exactly why it is fiction, because just educating people about stuff does nothing. What the study actually showed was that education has no effect. But you give them a program, then it helps. So this is good. In fact, this is, ironically, just like 2 days ago, I was talking to one of our new residents about this very fact, that a lot of medical care is premised on physicians educating patients about what they should be doing. You should quit smoking, and you should eat right, and you should exercise. But the evidence all shows that it doesn't work. It's interesting. A lot of what we do is not evidence-based, in that educating people about what they should be doing doesn't work. People are not rational beings at the end of the day. We don't do things because we should do them. If you want to affect statistically a population of people, you have to make their good choices easier, right? So you have to affect their choices. Or you have to use social pressures to do it. You have to use peer pressure, to get them to change their choices. So you have to, instead of telling them about the benefits of exercise and what they should be doing, you give them a very specific program, you give them manageable goals, and you make them track what they're doing, track their own progress, write down what they do, and report it. And that works.
Depressing. Okay, fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to know, though. I mean, given that that's true,
it's good to know.
It's very empowering to know that. You just, whatever the context is, raising kids, treating patients, trying to reduce drunk driving or whatever, that just the scared straight programs don't work. You got to do this little bit of social engineering. You got to affect their choices,
That's too bad, because today at the office, some woman brought her children in, and I commented that it was probably like a scared straight program to make sure kids don't end up in cubicle farms. but sadly, those children are probably lost.
Right, right.
Okay, I have a quote. Can I do the quote? And the quote is, wait, did we decide we're saying who it is beforehand? I think we did,
right? It's up to Jay.
It's up to
Jay. Well, he's not here. What do I do?
We decided it was up to Jay.
I have a quote from Mark Twain, and this was a quote that was mentioned by a commenter on Skeptic, considering very apropos, considering all of the goings-on of the past few weeks. Mark Twain said, "We despise all reverences and all the objects of reverence which are outside the pale of our own list of sacred things, and yet, with strange inconsistency, we are shocked when other people despise and defile the things which are holy to us." Mark Twain.
He totally got it.
Oh, yeah.
Twain.
Yeah, right?
He did.
Yeah.
He was good people.
Wonderful.
Love that guy.
I have not read enough of him, and I will eventually catch up in my life by reading his collective work.
Such an observer of the human condition.
Oh,
too many people stop after Huck Finn in eighth grade or whatever. Keep going.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Well, thank you all again for joining me. A pleasure
as
always. Do we have any announcements for next week? We are planning a September live event in New York, and this will be the first annual Perry DeAngelis Memorial event. We will hopefully have all the details available for you next week.
Save the date.
And stay
whatever
tuned.
Date that might be.
Yeah, so stay tuned. We don't have any. I have a tentative date, but I don't want to give it out until it's final. So hopefully by next week we'll have everything finalized. But it will be kind of at the endish of September.
And Boston Skeptics in the Pub is Monday, July 28th. BostonSkeptics.com.
Yeah, which is my daughter's 9th birthday.
That's right.
Happy birthday. Oh, and come see us at Dragon Con, everyone.
That's true. Bob, Evan, and I will be at Dragon Con in Atlanta, Georgia from August 29th to the 31st. I will be giving a lecture on science-based medicine. We're going to hopefully be having a debate between skeptics and true believers. And the three of us are going to be recording a live SGU show at Dragon Con. I was also asked to announce that Dean Cameron is doing his show, The Nigerian Spam Scam Scam, Tuesday, July 29th and Wednesday, July 30th at the Reno Is Art Town Festival in beautiful Reno, Nevada. Check it out at renoisarttown.com. So thanks again for joining me, everyone.
Thank you.
Surely.
Thank you, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.